Hello and welcome to another exciting episode of Angel Insights, where we hear from some of the top performing business angels in the UK and the entrepreneurs behind some of their portfolio companies. I'm your host, Tom Britton, co-founder of Syndicate Room, creators of the Access EIS Fund, which uses data to identify some of the top performing angels in the UK and builds a fund that co-invests with these angels. But enough about me, let's get to the show. Simon, it's a pleasure to have you on the show. Thanks for joining us today.
Thanks, Tom, for having me.
Before we dive into angel investing, I wanted to talk a little bit about your experience before angel investing and your time in the city, and maybe explore a little bit about how that translated into angel investing. So you started your career with KPMG, if I'm not mistaken, and you were working in accounts or as an accountant. What was that like?
Actually, extremely boring, to be honest. The one thing accounting taught me was actually taught me the discipline of finance. And that's really, really important. It gives you credibility when you're sitting around a board table that you actually understand the numbers and you understand a P&L and balance sheet. But actually, I was always interested in much more creative stuff than that. And so essentially in the city, I worked in the city for 22 years researching companies. And that's actually what led me to angel investing. I didn't know it at the time, but I was really interested in what made companies tick. I was interested in tech and life sciences back in the 1990s because essentially, if you were selling shares to growth investors around the world, where was the growth? It was largely in tech and life sciences. You know, this is 30 years ago.
This was when you were with UBS.
Indeed. And UBS was very well known for global research, and it was selling research to all the big institutions, all the big institutional investors. And so that was really the sort of how I ended up being an investor in tech and life sciences as an angel investor in the last 10 years or so.
And when you were coming to your end of time with UBS, did you know that you wanted to go into from there investing in startups, or was it a gradual transition?
No, I didn't know that. Actually, I always wanted to be an entrepreneur. In fact, I sort of was an entrepreneur when I was a teenager. Both my parents were entrepreneurs. They ran their own individual businesses. My mum always used to say to me, there's no such thing as I can't. and so I kind of grew up with that. And I always thought I wanted to run my own business. And I left UBS in 2008 to run my own business. And I actually found an idea very quickly that somebody else had that was, they were doing it much better than I was, and decided to invest in them.
This is Delta 2020?
Yeah, so Delta 2020 was really set up as a means to consult and mentor and coach, which is what I do. All my investments are made as an individual as opposed to a fund.
Backtracking just a little bit. So we want to explore due diligence for a second here. When you're looking at a company, and you mentioned being an accountant, startups are required to put together these financial forecasts early on. And it's usually like a 3-year forecast or a 5-year forecast. And you and I have been here a while in the space. And we know that most of what gets produced is pretty ludicrous and far-fetched and will never be hit. But with your training and experience in accounting, what is it that you're actually looking for in that forecast that makes you think like, okay, this person not is sane, but has a chance of potentially hitting that forecast?
So this is a great question because it's misunderstood, I think, by many people. And I think I've always thought about accounting in terms of financial accounting, which is largely backward looking, and a position in time. What does the balance sheet look like at a point in time? And management accounting and forecasting, which is much more forward looking. And the whole purpose of having forward looking forecasts is not what the number actually is or the numbers actually are. It's what actually drives those numbers? What are the assumptions that are made behind the model? And for me, the most important thing when I meet entrepreneurs is that they've actually thought 5 years ahead, and they thought, what assumptions might be appropriate to my business and to my vision of the future? Bearing in mind that many of these companies that we're looking to invest in as startups, there may not even be a market for their product at the time that they've got the idea that there's a product. Best entrepreneurs are creating a new market. So it's pretty difficult to put in place hard and fast numbers. So I'm really looking to see the entrepreneurs have really understood the assumptions that they're making in the forecast that they're presenting to us.
And are there any things that you would say are good assumptions versus bad assumptions, or lines of thought that you can share with us?
Well, I think it's quite difficult to generalize because obviously it depends on the sector or the business. Things I don't like to see are, I think the market's worth 100. We're going to have 10% market share within 2 years. Therefore, our revenue is 10. That doesn't work. I don't like to see that at all. That is definitely something not to do. But what's really important is that you've actually thought through the size of the market, the addressable market, and how are you breaking that market down? How are you thinking about it geographically? Is this a global market? Are there a number of specialist verticals within this market? And so on. And those are the sorts of assumptions I do want to see. I really want to understand that the entrepreneurs thought about where they can sell their product or service.
Speaking about market size, obviously having a big market is important, but I think entrepreneurs are often under the impression that it should be worth billions of pounds. Is there ever a case where you'll look at a company that is going after a much smaller niche market? And how do you approach that versus, say, something that's global?
Well, I think this is a good question, because actually angels can often find businesses that can grow from being, say, a 2 or 5 million pound business to being a 100 million pound business. And that would be a very nice outcome for an angel investor. But that sort of outcome won't be ambitious enough for a venture capitalist. So venture capitalists are looking for growth opportunities with real scale. They're not looking for niches. So there are plenty of niches that actually where people can build really credible businesses, create value, create jobs. They may not be VC investable, but so what? Not everybody wants to go down the VC route. We're fortunate that there are so many more VCs around with lots of money and more sophisticated analysis that that is a much more open and viable funding mechanism, but it's not the only one.
No, and you've hit it there with an angel going in quite early. You're often taking on much more risk because the traction might not be there. But at the same point in time, as you just said, they don't have to be a unicorn at the billions of valuations for you to get a good return. So let's look at the metrics, though, that you do look at and the other things you look at early on when they don't necessarily have traction with the market.
One of the ways I think about businesses is, you know, what am I looking for when I first invest? And so clearly I'm looking for an outstanding team. And of course, everybody says that, but you need to think that through quite carefully. What does an outstanding team look like? What sort of individuals are involved? Are there 1, 2, 3, or 4 individuals? Many VCs only want to invest in founders where there are 2 founders, 1 commercial, 1 technical. And then you're thinking about, well, what is the technology? What's the IP? How big is the market? As we've just discussed. But you're then trying to look ahead 5 to 10 years and say, is this team capable of growing and building this business over a 5 to 10 year period? They may be great at producing the idea, but maybe they're not good at commercializing it. Maybe they're not so good at building a team. Maybe they're not so good at execution. All the boring executional stuff that comes with after the original innovation. That's important.
On that point, when you get involved, if you don't think the team is necessarily right or if it's missing something, will you still invest on the assumption that they might be able to hire that person in? Or do you want to see the team set before you get involved?
It is possible to change teams. It's possible to enhance teams, but it's quite difficult to fundamentally change teams. And if you're talking about, you know, I've seen many examples where the founders haven't been up to it. They don't really recognize they're up to it. And it's very difficult to remove them and change the business for the better. So it's very hard. I mean, many investors will tell you it's very hard to change the original founders, and it can be enormously distracting.
Okay. So changing hard, but adding to a solid team, obviously much easier. So we've learned a little bit about your due diligence. Let's see how this is applied to some of the companies that you've added to your portfolio. And the first is the well-known one with SwiftKey. SwiftKey, for anyone that's not aware, they built a AI-powered keyboard for mobile phones that ultimately sold to Microsoft for a reported lot of money. We won't go into exact amounts. You got into SwiftKey rather early. Talk us through kind of what your first interactions with them were and what stood out, particularly on why you thought they could be competitive in a market that already had the incumbents like Google and Microsoft and Apple developing their own keyboards. Like, what was it that you said, yeah, they can compete?
So a couple of really key points here. One is that how did I get into it? Well, it's actually about networks. It's about being connected with trusted individuals. And it was actually an individual I started to know quite well through working together on another business. And he introduced me to SwiftKey and said, look, I'm doing this. This is why I think this is an excellent idea. And immediately he said it. I said, I get it. I want to meet them. The rest is history. But why did I think they could compete with the big tech companies that you've just described? Well, essentially, it was a crack team, and they had specific expertise in natural language processing. And at that stage, you have to think back quite a few years. If you think the Apple iPhone, that only came out in 2007, touchscreen smartphones were quite a new thing at that stage. And then, of course, we had a lot more of them. So it was that period from 2007 through to sort of, well, I suppose when SwiftKey exited 2015, where there was a great deal of demand for predictive text in a much better way than on the old Nokia T9. And you could see that this was going to be a vast improvement on the existing technologies. And the big guys, for whatever reason, they weren't really doing this, and not at that stage. So SwiftKey was well ahead of time there, based on really strong IP, you know, out of Cambridge, essentially. The business was based in London, ultimately.
With that situation where you've got a small team, well-funded, but not huge amounts of funding, and they're in a way going up against, say, the Googles and Microsofts, how do you know if backing that company is the right thing or not? Because, you know, Microsoft could have turned around and said, you know what, we're going to do this internally and we're going to spend $50 million on our own team. We're going to build something even better because we're Microsoft. I find it amazing that they ended up getting bought out and integrated. Does that happen a lot?
Well, you don't, but at the start, you don't know that. You don't know that one of the big players isn't going to put you out of business. You don't know that. But what you do know is that you can build quite quickly. You know, small companies are fleet of foot. They can change and move quickly, much more quickly than the big companies can. And of course, when you're working on something really exciting like that, you can hire really good talent. And SwiftKey were able to hire lots of software engineers. And actually, by the time they sold to Microsoft in 2015, they had about 130, 140 people, probably nearly 100 of whom were software engineers. So from Microsoft's point of view, they were getting a brand, they were buying great people, and they were buying technology that nobody else had. Why wouldn't you buy it if you were Microsoft? Because you're getting all of that, which you'd have to build yourself, and it would take you a long time. It turned out to be a very good acquisition for them.
Yeah, and a very good return for investors. Obviously, being an angel, you've also had some situations that haven't gone so well. That's why you create portfolios in multiple ambitious companies. Can we talk a little bit about some of the ones that haven't gone too well and some of the lessons that you've learned from those experiences?
Of course. So, you know, I always say that if you don't have any failures, you're not trying hard enough. and let's face it, this is a very risky asset class. It has become an asset class over the last 10 years. But it is risky and you should expect companies to fail. In my own case, I've invested over 50 companies since 2009. I've had 9 exits, 7 failures to date, and sort of roughly just over 30 companies still in the portfolio. Interestingly, most of mine that have failed have been outside the digital world. In fact, every single company in my current portfolio is a digital play of some sort. Those that have failed, there's a number of core themes, I would say. One is that is the management. Were they actually up to developing the vision that they sold at the beginning? And in many cases, they weren't. I've had an example of where a company's business model was clearly not right, but it took 2 to 3 years to work that out. That wasn't really the team's fault. In that case, it wasn't an issue about the team. It was more that the business model fundamentally wasn't going to work. And there was a very comprehensive exercise to work out whether a certain pivots would work. And the conclusion was that they wouldn't. And rightly, the company decided that it wasn't right to go and raise more money when it actually couldn't work out how to monetize a business model. So at that point, it elegantly failed, i.e., you know, not owing any creditors any money.
And for that particular instance where you had a good team, but they couldn't quite get the business model to work out, if they came up to you with another opportunity, theoretically in the future, would you back them again, having had that one failure in your portfolio from them? Would you consider it?
Well, actually, in that case, they did. They did come back. Both the two individuals came back separately in different guises. I happen to believe probably both of those individuals will be successful in their different ways in the future. It taught them a lot. And there was good relationship actually between the investors and the original entrepreneurs because there was still a relationship of trust. And that was because there was a proper discussion about the pivoting, about the possible, could we find a new business model or not? And then there was, you know, we reached agreement collectively that it was the right thing to do is to fold the company. That's a professional way to do it.
I'm going to go back a little bit because you mentioned the importance of networks in finding SwiftKey. And then clearly networks are important on the deal flow side of it. And you belong to a fair few networks. Yeah, we mentioned Cambridge Angels, we mentioned CCG and Angel Academy. I wasn't aware of this until before the show, but you're actually one of the founding members of Angel Academy.
Well, yes, I'm sort of grandly named as one of the founding members, but really, I wasn't really a founder as such. I was one of the very early members, and I actually sat on the Angel Academy board at the beginning. But this was really Sarah Turner's initiative. And why did she come up with the idea? She basically was sort of fed up of going to lots of angel meetings and, you know, weren't any women in the room. And quite rightly, she thought, well, how am I going to change this? And she thought, I needed to do two things. One, she said, well, I need to find more females who are actually actively prepared to invest in companies. And I want to try and attract investment towards female entrepreneurs. And that's what her model has done. And she's built up a group over 6 years, which is doing exactly that. And it's now become an established angel group. It does take time. You know, it takes, like building a business, it takes 5 to 10 years to build something like this.
We've seen that there's been an effort to increase the number of women getting involved in angel investing. This is being pushed by Sarah and her team and other groups and the UKBAA. But more present, there's now an interest in improving diversity beyond having more women, but having more ethnic minorities involved in angel investing. It's something that I wanted to talk to you a little bit about because you obviously saw the need for it with Angel Academy, but I'd love to talk about what needs to be done to include more people in angel investing.
This is a great question. It's not a trivial topic. There are many dimensions to it. I think, first of all, if we think about what's been done well over the last 10 years, is there has been a lot of progress. It may not seem like it, but there has been a lot of progress. I see a lot more female entrepreneurs now than I did 10 years ago. A lot more. A third of my portfolio are run by women. A third of the investment opportunities we've seen through Cambridge Angels this year have been run by women or have at least one female founder. That's an enormous improvement from 5 years ago, let alone 10 years ago. We see many more founders of color now, but the diversity is a bit mixed. You know, you tend to see a lot of Indian and Asian heritage, but not so much Black heritage. So there's some things around that need thinking through. And I think there's already a much greater awareness. So there are firms like Cornerstone Partners who are doing things in, you know, to try and promote Black entrepreneurs. So there's a greater awareness now, which is also, I think, really, really important. But, you know, what can we do to help? Try and help those people where give them the same opportunity that those that white males like me get. Try and help other people who won't necessarily get those opportunities. And that's partly back to your networking point, Tom, because many of these people don't have developed networks. And so they need help developing them. So if I can connect people together, then that's something I can do to help.
That's a great starting point. And for anyone who's not Googled you, you know, you are very open about how to get in touch. You know, you've got the Delta 2020 website, you've got your LinkedIn and such, but you put yourself out there to be contacted, which is definitely a good starting point. One question that I like to ask everybody is, with the benefit of hindsight, what is one key thing that you'd like to have known when you were at the start of your angel investing career? You know, if you could go back and just say one thing, what would it be?
Well, if it's one thing, really good businesses take time to grow. And actually, when I look back at the experience I've had over the last 10, 12 years, the best businesses will take 10 to 15 years to grow to a sizable exit. It's possible to do it in 5 to 10 years. It's possible. It sometimes happens in 18 months or 2 years, but it's very, very rare that that happens. So you've got to think about a long timetable. It's called patient capital for a reason. And linked with that, don't sell too early, because your best ones, your oranges, take longer to ripen than your lemons, and you've got to stick with your oranges.
Good advice. I think worthy to end the show. Simon, it's been a pleasure. Thank you for joining us today. I do hope that we can revisit this conversation in 6 to 12 months' time. Thanks for coming along.
Pleasure. Thanks, Tom.
You've been listening to Angel Insights, produced by Syndicate Room. Until next time, bye.